for Netflix, I think they were looking for somebody with ads experience and also experience with forecasting.
Yeah.
Typically, people who will have experience in one or the other, but usually not both. Mm. So I would say when they reached out, because I had experience in both, that helped me a lot. So I would say, like, when you think about like different skill sets, if you can find these like intersection of skill sets that are really highly valued within the industry, that kind of helps you build a bit of a personal moat in the marketplace for work, because then it's hard to find another person with those two exact skill sets.
Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. Today we have Jeff Lee. Jeff is a senior data scientist at Netflix, focusing on ads forecasting. Previously, he was a data science manager at Spotify, worked on supply forecasting, demand forecasting, and data infrastructure. He studied business from University of Southern California. Today, we're going to talk about ads forecasting, a career as a manager versus individual contributor, culture in Spotify, Netflix, and DoorDash, and how to develop your unique career skill. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Daliana. Excited to be here and excited to share.
Yeah. So how did you get into data science?
Yeah, so I got into data science, initially started in technology consulting, and at the time, really didn't like technology consulting. So I was spending a lot of time outside of work playing poker, and I was trying to get good at that. It didn't really work out, but I really liked the analytical and statistics side of playing poker. So as a result of that, I ended up self-studying a lot of data science, went through a boot camp, and then also ended up just getting my first job.
Oh, cool. And now working on forecasting, can you tell us what are some typical use cases in forecasting, and give us an overview of some projects you worked on, maybe start from those in Spotify?
Yeah, so I would say just high level forecasting could be applied in a lot of different areas. The most popular area or the most common area that forecasting is applied to is financial forecasting, and you don't really need to know data science to do financial forecasting. A lot of financial analysts do that kind of work as well, but really kind of the goal there is to actually estimate, hey, where's revenue going to land? Where is, you know, for my company case, subscribers, where's subscribers going to land? And ultimately, investors want to know what's going to happen to your business so they can properly value your company. So that's really the most common use case, and you'll see that just at all companies that are public. So that's very common. There's a lot of other common use cases, such as like inventory optimization. So if you think of a supermarket, they want to be able to fill their shelves. So a lot of times you need to actually be able to forecast the sales, forecast what people are going to buy in order for you to properly stack the shelves. I would say, yeah, those are probably like two common use cases.
Yeah. And if we compare the forecasting in the finance world versus ads forecasting, what are some similarities and differences?
Yeah, so the core use case is that, well, ads forecasting could be used for a couple different things. So for those of you who are not familiar with ads, let's assume that you're watching TV, right? You're watching TV. You have a bunch of commercials and you have to watch all the commercials, right? If you look behind the scenes of a TV in the commercial, somebody needs to sell those commercial slots and there needs to be buyers of those commercial slots, right? So in order for a business to be able to sell those commercial slots, they need to be able to predict how many commercial slots there's going to be. And a lot of times when you watch a show or watch a TV show, you don't know how many people are actually going to watch it. So that's actually where the predictive modeling component comes in.
Yeah.
So at, like, just this use case I described, it's really kind of more for a sales and operational use case. In order for the business to run, we need accurate forecast numbers so we can actually go fill those ad slots, say fill those TV commercial slots. Compare that with finance. In financial forecasting, the goal is actually to estimate how much revenue is going to come into the business so we can actually properly value or properly value the stock on the stock market. So really kind of to boil it down, the summary is that operational use case for ads forecasting. And for finance, it's more of a financial planning use case.
Mm, yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong. When you're working on forecasting finance, maybe you can just have a Jupyter notebook. You run it once a month, and then you give insights to your stakeholders, but it doesn't need to connect into some other infrastructure or go into production. But while you're working in ads forecasting, it's very deeply embedded into the entire engineering platform. You need to deal with latency and fatals. Can you elaborate on the type of differences there?
Yeah. So because financial planning, the use case is really just every quarter when you're offering your financial results, the requirements for productionization is a lot lower. So what you have to do, all you really need to do is run a Jupyter notebook, output a CSV file, and you can just email that CSV file to whoever needs it. And then maybe like you touch it up in a PowerPoint slide or something, versus for something that has a more operational use case and you need it to actually either refresh daily or you need it to actually get a prediction based off request, there's going to be a lot more stringent productionization requirements depending on the stage of the business and where the business is.
And what was the biggest challenge in finance forecasting? Because I don't think you can exactly predict the financial results. It's probably going to be an interval. And what would be, say, the potential loss if the prediction is off?
Mm-hmm. So I have worked less in financial forecasting. Mm-hmm. I've done it more for the operational use cases.
Yeah.
But what I do know with financial forecasting is that, one, you're making guesses about the future, but they're heavily informed by business intuition on what leadership believes as well is going to happen. So you might get a number based off the seasonality trend over the last year. But a lot of times leadership will come in saying, hey, these initiatives are going to happen, so we think that's going to actually bump up the forecast a little bit. And there's also like leadership is also very cognizant of, if we give a certain number, how is that going to land on Wall Street? Do we want to be more conservative or be more aggressive? So when you think about financial planning, the more conservative you are in your estimate, that lowers your expectations on Wall Street.
Yeah.
But what happens is if you have too low of a forecast, your stock price is going to just could potentially crater when you give a lower than expected forecast. On the other hand, if you give a higher than expected forecast, your stock price might go up, but you have higher expectations now. So you just have to perform for the quarter, because if you miss those expectations, then that's actually going to hurt your stock price even more. So there's a bit of a balancing act where you want to give yourself some room to succeed, but if you also don't want to overpromise to Wall Street, because either way can actually hurt your stock price.
Yeah, so the stake is pretty high. It sounds like the outcome of the forecasting directly impact how Wall Street perceives your company.
Exactly. Especially for financial forecasting, it can directly impact how Wall Street perceives your company.
Wow. And what about ads forecasting? What is the challenges there? What are some risks out there?
So with ads forecasting, the difference is we're not relaying any information to Wall Street in this case, but instead we're actually just relaying information to people that need to use the forecast. So the consequences of an inaccurate forecast for ads forecasting is that basically, when you're predicting the number of ads that's going to happen on your platform, the sales teams will basically take your numbers and try to go out and sell against the numbers you give them. If you under forecast, you will directly cut into the amount of inventory that salespeople will go out and sell. So you'll actually have a more direct impact on revenue than, say, financial forecasting. Because financial forecasting is really going to impact like whether people buy your stock or not.
Right.
Versus the ads, like operational forecast, is going to actually cut into how much money you're going to make. If you over forecast in ads forecasting, what happens is that advertisers that want to advertise on your platform, you're essentially over promising them the amount of inventory that is on your platform.
Gotcha.
So what happens is that advertisers will be upset if you over promise them, because you tell me, hey, I want to buy these number of ads, but I just come back and tell you, sorry, we don't actually have enough inventory to fulfill your request. And then you'll probably be a little bit upset.
Yeah, because now your stakeholders are those sales account managers.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Can you tell us more about the production side of ads forecasting?
Yeah, so at a high level, there's a lot of different components of an ads forecast. Mm. So I'll assume like the listeners here don't know ads, so I'll keep it very high level.
Sure.
Where basically there are different components that have different types of productionization you need. The typical ones in ML in general are batch productionization and streaming productionization. So typically what happens is when we just need to get total inventory numbers, batch productionization can suffice. I think initially it can suffice. As your business gets more and more complicated and you need things more and more real time, then we need to start transitioning over to streaming. So there's a lot of things that go into computing the forecast, how much is actually available. And it also really depends on how big your marketplace is. Are you dealing with big advertisers or just small advertisers? Is it like an auction-based system or not? So a lot of those variables will kind of affect whether you want to productionize it via batch or streaming.
Gotcha. So there's a lot of methodologies in forecasting. You can start with regression models or RIMA or using, say, neural network, LSTM. So how do you decide what methodology to use?
So I would probably break the forecasting life cycle into three different phases. So like for ads, your question's around ads, right?
Or
just in general?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we talk about ads, what happens is, let's say you just first start your ads business. You have nothing. You have no data. So essentially, it becomes a cold start forecasting problem. And typically, when you need to do something cold start, it's tricky because you just don't have that much data to work with. So you actually probably need to do something a little bit more finicky and complex and make a lot of assumptions around what you're guessing. Then what happens is you have this very complex model, and over time you will start to collect more data. And once you have like about 1 to 2 years of data, you actually have a good amount where it's actually going to outdate your very complex model, because your complex model is based off all these assumptions that you made before, but now you have data. So you actually don't need to make those assumptions because you have historical data. So typically then what happens is you can probably revert to more simple approaches, such as like ARIMA, exponential smoothing models, basic time series models can work, because the benefit of these simple approaches is that you can explain it very easily.
Yeah.
It's easy to debug, and you can easily go to like stakeholders and say, hey, this is why we're off. The good part is that when you have a simpler approach, your stakeholders, it's easier to build trust with your stakeholders, and it's easier to be nimble and make changes to the forecast when you have to. So I think once you have like kind of a stable, simple forecast, then you can start adding some more complexity to it. So, and I think that the benefit of doing it this way is that by having something simple, you know something is at least going to work 50%.
Right.
Because an LSTM or a transformer, if you use that, it's a little high risk. You don't know if it's going to work. And if it doesn't work, it's a lot harder to know why it doesn't work.
Right.
So the way I kind of think about it is, if we want to de-risk it to the point where we want to make sure the model is actually going to provide business value, let's do something simple first, make sure we capture at least some of the value, and then see if like a more complicated method can actually capture more of that value. So I kind of break it down into complex, you go simple, and then you can potentially go back to being more complex.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I also assume there won't be just one model. Maybe you are stacking multiple models for, say, different regions or different device type. Can you tell us what is like the hierarchy of those model architects?
So I would say like the hierarchy really just depends on, it actually should be business informed. So I would actually say you should just start off very high level first. It depends on what product you're selling, especially in ads. So if your ads are like, if you're just selling one product, you can just do one forecast. But I think what happens is the business will get more and more complicated. So like, for example, if you look at any kind of service like Netflix or Spotify, like people will start wanting to buy not just high level. They also want to buy, you know, this particular show or this particular title, right? Mm. And then if they want to get more detailed there, we actually need a lower level forecast.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different hierarchical approaches. You can do a bottoms up. You forecast everything at a low level.
Yeah.
Aggregate it up. You can forecast it at a high level. You can do it, you know, it depends on the combinations of how people want to buy it. So I think the real takeaway is that you set the hierarchy based off the business and what the business wants to sell and how they want to sell, and that'll determine the hierarchy.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how do you choose the right metrics to measure your forecasting model, especially when you have this hierarchy and you have your baseline, maybe a simpler model and those more complicated model?
So the common metric in forecasting is mean absolute percentage error. So MAPE is just a common one in forecasting.
Yeah.
There are pitfalls to it. So if you're using a hierarchical forecasting approach, when you start to get deeper in the hierarchies, if those hierarchies are very sparse, then MAPE is going to start to become an unstable. Because if you just imagine, if you only have two data points in a hierarchy, if you like forecast one off, that's like 50% error already. So you have to be careful you have enough data in the hierarchies to use MAPE. But if not, you could, there's like other metrics such as like mean absolute scaled error. You can use RMSE or MAE as well. Those are totally valid. So a lot of the regression metrics are valid as well.
Yeah. And your stakeholders are usually sales leaders. How do you communicate those stats metrics to them?
Yeah, so typically the way we change it is you will communicate it via average error. That's like the easiest to understand to stakeholders, where they average error, they can see like, okay, yeah, that's how often we're off by. But what I also realize is that you have to like take it a step further. Like, it doesn't really matter if your average error is low, but your business is not realizing the value. Like, you can have a perfect forecast, but if your business stakeholders don't trust it, that doesn't matter. Like, then your mean, like MAPE doesn't actually matter.
Yeah.
So that's actually really the hardest part with a lot of these forecasting metrics, is that how do you articulate it in a way so that your stakeholders actually trust the forecast on top of having a very accurate score? Typically, like if you have a low error rate, then it's correlated with stakeholders, you know, trusting it more, but you still need to take that extra step to ensure that they actually understand and they actually trust your forecast.
Right. So if you say your forecasting is off by a certain percentage, maybe for this specific account, you might lose some money, or you over promise the customers, or you under promise the customers might, you know, also lose some opportunity. So I'm curious, do you translate the MAPE, the metrics, into a dollar amount impact when you communicate with them?
Yeah, so I've done that many times to size out accuracy improvements.
Yeah.
I think that you want to just be careful directly translating that to them, because I think that like it's a very like directional estimate when you translate accuracy improvements.
Yeah.
So I would, like, if you do that, you should definitely preempt it with it being a directional estimate. I also tend to give a confidence interval versus like an absolute number. So that way stakeholders know that, hey, like, this is just a guess. I don't actually know.
Right.
Because it's like, for ads forecasting, at least, like if you under forecast, you can directly calculate the loss in revenue. But if you over forecast, it's hard to quantify client unhappiness.
Yeah.
That's like hard to know. Like, they might still be around, but they might gradually just start spending less money on your platform. So that's like a lot harder to quantify. So we also want to just be careful of that as well.
Yeah. So for example, I might be a clothing company advertising on Netflix, or another company might be, say, vitamin company. So they might have different risk tolerance or different preference. So when you do forecasting for those different type of customers, do you have a different framework?
So like for different types of advertisers, right? So Yeah, I would say like for different types of advertisers, there are different requirements for forecasting. Mm. So an example is like there's some types of advertisers that are only going to advertise a certain time of the year.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, like presidential campaigns, let's say they want to advertise, there's like a set time of the year where that has to happen, versus like other advertisers, which are general, they can advertise any time of the year because they're always selling things. Mm. So for a lot of advertisers with like, they have a set time of the year where they want to advertise, much stricter requirements for forecasting versus advertisers that are just like a little bit more on the end of like, oh yeah, like we're just looking to make money throughout the year. So it really depends on the advertiser.
Mm. And I think your stakeholder, the sales manager, account manager, they have a lot of information about what their customer needs. But sometimes they might also find it difficult to communicate directly about, you know, what the forecasting team can provide to their customers. Have there ever been cases they want you to join them in the conversation with the customer?
It's pretty rare for them to bring me into that conversation. The reason why is there's a lot of salespeople.
Yeah.
And it's like not really scalable for me to join all those conversations.
Right.
So usually I do not. And actually probably as in terms of like my best use of time is it's probably not the best use of my time to be in those sales meetings. But I think what is a good use of time is to talk to salespeople and get an understanding of their problems.
Mm.
So, I mean, I guess it doesn't hurt to be in one client meeting, but I would say like typically like scaling wise, there's always like hundreds of salespeople.
Right.
So it may not be always feasible to like go to them and explain the forecast and that.
Yeah. It sounds like you are building different type of models for different type of account. I'm sure there's maybe some common model or some base module that you can use it repeatedly. I'm curious, have you helped your sales stakeholder create some kind of self-service instead of every time customize the solution for them?
Yeah, so there's a self-service where we built out tools before where a salesperson can just go in and run a, like a pull their own forecast based off what they need. So
yeah,
custom solution is also not scalable. If I have to run a Jupyter notebook to give them a number every time, that's not going to be scalable. So we do create tools to provide.
And has there been cases when you provide a solution to the sales manager, but they just couldn't trust the solution or they have doubts? How do you handle those situations?
So I think the key thing is like forecasting is not perfect and we're never going to be 100% right.
Yeah.
So it's really like an action of just managing other people's expectations on what they can expect. There's been many times where we've given a bad number. And I would say that when we do give a bad number, salespeople can usually flag it. And sometimes it'll go to somebody who can actually just custom, like manually adjust it to something that actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, like a lot of times, the forecast is just missing certain business context where we're like, okay, we know that for this show, this thing is going to happen. But like our forecast is not going to capture that.
Right.
So you still need to be somewhat, you definitely need to be business informed to know whether it makes sense or not.
Yeah. So what you provide kind of more, it's, so what you provide probably more on the directional side of things, and then they can use their own expertise to adjust the number.
Not salespeople should not do that.
Mm.
But I would say like there's other people who could have the role to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because if salespeople are just adjusting numbers, then
they're
it's probably not the best use of their time.
Mm.
And also I don't think they usually want to be trying to do that.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So you provide your number from a kind of more technical side, and then there's some maybe like more strategic, help them maybe adjust the number. Someone has the business acumen, and then salesperson takes that final number and go talk to their clients.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Gotcha. Oh, there's like so many different type of steps.
Yeah.
And then this is very a collaborative type of work. So how is your impact measured? What is like the success, for example, when you go into an annual review?
Yeah. So I think the way impact is measured with forecasting is there's probably two buckets. Like the first bucket is just making the model more accurate. So if you can actually get more wins on the accuracy side, that's like usually going to be really beneficial to the business. Mm. The second bucket is more operational improvements. So for the business, in order for the business to be successful, the business has to launch a lot of different products.
Right.
So part of it is on our end to actually integrate a lot of these products into the forecast. Mm. So being able to deliver on actually providing forecasts for these new products is like another component of delivery. Mm. I think the third bucket actually is also just making the system more efficient and more effective.
Right.
So making the user experience better, making it faster. These are kind of like more product changes as well.
Yeah.
So those are probably the three buckets of impact.
Gotcha. So you don't just care about the performance of the specific ML model, but also the infrastructure.
Yeah, infrastructure, mm-hmm. What kind of like operational kind of products or ad products this can unlock.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's probably what I would say.
Oh, cool. And when you work on ads forecasting, for example, maybe sometimes if you spend a few more weeks in this forecasting, you can improve the accuracy, or maybe something that improves the accuracy will increase the latency. So what kind of trade-offs you have to make when you think about the entire picture?
Between like improving accuracy,
product. Yeah, model performance, and also kind of production metrics like latency or number of fatals, etc.
Yeah, how do I like prioritize across the three, right? Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky thing. Mm. It's not super apples to apples across all three, but the way I think about it is like there's a bucket of impact against level of effort.
Mm.
And I also think about it from the stakeholder perspective of trust and business strategy. Mm. So it's kind of a balancing act where we want to improve the accuracy of the overall system because that'll make everything more effective. Operations people and salespeople are typically not directly asking for more accuracy. They're asking us to make changes, add new products.
Mm.
And then I would also say from an infrastructure perspective, our business stakeholders are never really asking us for that. Like a lot of the infrastructure types of tasks, like refactoring, making things faster, are really like to make us more productive. Because if it's like, if you have bad code, it's like really hard to actually do better work on it. So yeah, I actually wouldn't say I've fully figured out a great formula for approaching like how do you balance all three of these itself. I would say the way we've done it is that we still anchor it all in business impact.
Mm-hmm.
So like we think about it from the perspective of, okay, like if we improve accuracy by this much, how much impact is this going to enable?
Mm.
But also like the products that are launching, how important is this as a part of our business strategy? That's also, but then like with stakeholders, if they need us to do it, like we probably have to do it. And then for the infrastructure part, we think about it from the perspective of how much work does this unlock for us and how much faster long-term does it make? So usually I think of it as like a split. So maybe like 30% accuracy, 30% operations, 30% infrastructure. And we change those ratios depending on the business needs.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. So previously you worked on ads forecasting at Spotify, and now you're working on similar problems in Netflix. Can you tell us, how did you get into Netflix? Has your previous experience helped?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that wasn't really expecting to change jobs, but what happened is I've been working in ads forecasting for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
And I kind of developed this kind of unique skill set within both forecasting and ads. Netflix just started their new ads business, so they needed somebody directly with the experience that I had. So they reached out, and I interviewed, passed the interviews, and ended up getting the job.
Nice. So how is ads forecasting unique compared to the generic forecasting space?
Yeah, so I think the key thing is that for Netflix, I think they were looking for somebody with ads experience and also experience with forecasting.
Yeah.
Typically, people who like will have experience in one or the other, but usually not both. Mm. So I would say when they reached out, because I had experience in both, that helped me a lot and it built a really good case for me when joining the company. So I would say like when you think about like different skill sets, there is like if you can find these like intersection of skill sets that are really highly valued within the industry, that's like a great, like that kind of helps you build a bit of a personal moat in the marketplace for work, because then it's hard to find another person with those two exact skill sets.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you build this quote unquote personal moat, was it as you planned? Did you plan to be an expert in forecasting and ads, or it just happened?
No, I did not plan it. To be honest, I don't think most people plan to say, oh, I want to like work in ads. Mm. That's my dream. Yeah. I don't think anybody says that. I would say like what happened is, I think that like if we like go through my career at DoorDash, I think one of the benefits but also costs of DoorDash is I got to work on a lot of different problems at DoorDash. I worked on recommender systems. I worked on experimentation. I worked on like lead ranking, scoring ranking. I also worked on supply demand forecasting, and I also worked on pricing optimization. I got to work on a lot of different problems. So I got to get exposed to a lot of different areas.
Yeah.
And I kind of, from that exploration, I got to get a sense of the types of projects and problems that I enjoyed and the problems I like did not enjoy as much.
Yeah.
I think the good thing, like if you can find a place where you can actually get that exploration, that'll be best. And I actually think the best place to do it is in college, because it's like low risk. I think if you do that at a job, that's totally fine. I think the one thing is that if you're doing a lot of exploring, you don't really become an expert in a specific topic at that job. So you're just not going to grow your career as much. But there is like an argument to be made that you want to do both explore and then exploit.
Yeah.
So I think for me, what I found is that I found that I really like doing forecasting when I worked on supply and demand forecasting. I also really like causal inference as the topics. That's what I was most excited by. So when I moved to Spotify, I think the cool thing with the culture there is that it was a new team. So I got to kind of carve my own path.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, and luckily because I also like forecasting, there's a strong need for forecasting.
Yeah.
That like ended up being a really, really good fit. And then I kind of just exploited. Then I went into exploit mode and just focused on just like growing my skill set and becoming the subject matter expert at forecasting at Spotify.
Right. Yeah. I think that's what someone call it, a T-shaped career. Mm-hmm. You're a generalist, but you're also very deep in an area.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that now it's like I'm going to exploit, go deeper into an area, and then we'll reevaluate it down the line.
Yeah. So what do you like about forecasting?
Yeah, so I think that the thing I like about forecasting, I would say, I actually never thought about why I liked it, but I would say like a couple things come to mind is that there's a lot of overlap with forecasting, and I have a lot of background in business and finance, so there's a lot of overlap with forecasting and just like thinking about business and finance. Yeah. So that's one. It requires a lot more like business sense, I think, to do well in forecasting. Like if you compare that to other things, like if you're doing LLMs for like LLMs and ChatGPT or whatever, right? You're just trying to iterate on the model. Right. You're not going to be as connected to the business. Mm. You are going to, the business value is essentially just making the LLM better. If the LLM is better, people will subscribe more and create more business value, versus I think forecasting tends to have a more direct implication on the business and making business decisions. So it kind of leverages my background pretty well. I also find it's like technical enough to keep me interested, because if it's not technical enough, then I'm not interested.
Yeah.
And then it's also like very important to the business as well. So, and I also think it's very undervalued. It's very valuable, but it's not as sexy as working on NLP and LLMs or recommender systems. So probably a combination of those four things.
Cool.
Yeah.
And previously, when we talked about forecasting best practices, you mentioned this book called Forecasting Principle and Practices. Mm-hmm. So if we take a step back from ads forecasting and talk about forecasting in general, mm-hmm. for our audience, what are some best practices that you find useful in practice?
Best practices for just working on any forecasting problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I would say when looking at forecasting problems, I think the number one thing before you even diving into any modeling is to really understand the nature of the data that you are going to be working with. Because a lot of like what happens with forecasting is that there is like a natural pattern to how the data moves.
Mm.
And then once you understand that, then that's how you kind of pick the best model. So like I've seen problems where there's a natural exponential decay of it. And if you understand why there's a decay in the series, then you can kind of pick the right method to do it, to apply to it. So I really just saying understanding like, what drives the data and what's like the natural structure of the data.
Mm.
And once you understand that, then you can kind of find the best models. And to be honest, I think, you know, you can just like, there's a lot of different models out there that you can try. I would say like you can try all of them. In terms of other best practices, cross-validation wise, it's going to be slightly different from typical cross-validation.
Yeah.
So usually like expanding or sliding window approaches are the better approach, because you essentially want to simulate what's going to happen in the future as you repeatedly generate this forecast. So sliding windows or expanding windows tend to be the best ways to cross-validate.
Yeah.
And then the other common metrics tend to be MAPE. And I would say based off current research, the best performing models have been ensembles between univariate time series and also machine learning models. So yeah, I would say those are some best practices.
Yeah. And previously you gave example on the presidential campaign. So I think for different type of shows or different type of advertisers, there will be different type of seasonality affecting it. Mm-hmm. So how do you detect those type of seasonality, or what if there's some kind of black swan events? How do you factor in those, you know, different type of situation? For example, maybe another platform launched a similar show, or, you know, I don't know, something related to like network or entertainment, or could affect this show. So how do you consider that into your model?
Yeah, so there's a few questions in there. How do you detect seasonality?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the easiest way to detect it is just plot the time series and you can just visually see it. If you want something more mathematical, you can decompose your series into season. Like if you essentially remove the trend from the time series, you will be kind of left with the seasonality and white noise. So kind of the resulting errors.
Mm.
So basically then if you remove the trend, you can kind of detect the seasonality, and then you can like use that. You can fit Fourier series on top of it to kind of understand the cyclical nature of the seasonality. For black swan events, so like the nature of forecasting is that you're building a forecast off of historical data.
Yeah.
So if you have a black swan event, in theory, the historical data will not have that.
Mm.
I think there's a good book, Nassim Taleb, where he basically talks about this, where he's like, yeah, black swans are black swans because there's no historical data on this. So it's actually like fairly impossible to predict.
Mm.
So he kind of hates on forecasters as well,
which
I mean, I don't think he has a bad argument for it. So, but I would say like for black swans, you can't really predict it. Like COVID-19,
right.
I think that threw everybody, like every single company's forecasting team models off course. But I think it's really like with the model, how do you make it nimble enough that you can adjust for it? So there's a techniques to adjust for it after the fact, but it's kind of hard to predict black swan events, but things like competitors, you can do that. Basically you can back into it from like, getting a total addressable market share, and then you can basically get a TAM. You can compute your own forecast relative to TAM, And if you project the competitor growth rate, you can kind of use that ceiling to kind of figure out, okay, this is how it's going to slow my company's growth. Mm. So I think competitor-wise, that's like very doable. Black swan is kind of hard to do.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
And you mentioned forecasting is mostly using historical data to forecast the future. And now we also have a lot of information from social media. For example, the show is running and people are reacting to it. So do you analyze some kind of real-time data reaction during the show while adjusting your forecasting?
Yeah, so external, are you talking about like third-party social media external data? So we have used that. I would say it depends on the source, on how like strong they are in terms of features in the models.
Yeah.
I would say the ones... like we've typically tried to do that more so for cold start problem when we have nothing about a certain show. I would say in terms of like, at least for like podcast hosts using that data for guests, like we haven't tried it. I think my intuition says there could be some signal. The tricky part is that you need to know the guest earlier on.
Yeah.
Like ideally, if you know it a few months in advance, that'd be the best. Because if you just know it like tomorrow or next week, it's like less useful because we only have 2 days to act on it. So yeah, so there's probably signal in there. I think it just depends on the time frame.
Yeah, gotcha. And the traditional forecasting problem requires a lot of model interpretation, understanding the business problem. And now with the new wave of generative AI, large language models, do you see using LLM to make some predictions?
Yeah. So there's like transformers are definitely getting more popular as just because of LLMs, but like naturally like forecasting and text data are somewhat similar in that they're sequential, they're like sequences. I think the difference is that text data, there's more of like a right answer, I think, in text data. Like, does the sentence actually make grammatical sense? So there's a little bit more of a deterministic answer. And I think because of that, you could actually get better predictions through transformers versus like time series data is just inherently noisy. And there's no like deterministically correct time series. It's just like what happens in the real world, and there's all these random processes that affect how a time series behaves. So I think right now from reading papers that transformers can work. They haven't necessarily proven to be like the king of forecasting models. They could be at some point. We have no idea. But I would say that right now they're not like the clear-cut winner yet. So
How important is the interpretability of a model for you?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually say it's like very, very important to understand why we're off, which is like kind of a knock on transformers, is that I think if we compare it to text data, you can just like see the output. Does it actually make sense? With forecasting problems, you can still see the output. You can kind of tell if it makes sense, but it's less clear cut. Because it's not like reading a sentence and seeing if it makes sense. So I would say like for, and then in that case, it's really important for us to understand why the model actually like did that. And that's probably like the negative of these complicated models is that if it gives us a very weird forecast, we don't really know why it did that. And if we don't know why we did that, we don't know if it's actually right or not. So that's like the plus on a lot of these time series techniques is that very clear why it predicted this, and because it was very clear why, we can adjust it ourselves depending on that reason.
So previously while you were at Spotify, you're a data science manager, and now you go back to be a individual contributor. What is that shift for you?
Honestly, it's pretty easy. It's just like I'm basically shifting from juggling 10 different projects in my head to like two, which is nice. I have like 10 different projects in my head. It's like I have to have enough context to be able to like contribute conversationally to it. but I'm not actually doing the work, versus now I'm doing fewer work streams, but then I'm a lot more focused. So I just have a lot less meetings now. I got to do a lot more coding again. I'm actually doing the actual work again versus, you know, guiding somebody else to do it.
Yeah. And because you had experience as a manager, and now from that manager perspective, what kind of advice would you give yourself when you were, you know, an IC in your earlier career?
Yeah, so I think the thing with it being a manager is that you have to really be thinking about impact of your team. And when you're evaluating your team members, you're really looking at what have they delivered and what's like the impact they've made over the last 6 to 12 months, right? So I think that what happens is, like, as an IC, especially when you're younger, you focus a lot on doing the work and executing the work.
Yeah.
But you don't think as much about whether the work is impactful or not. So I made a mistake when I was earlier in my career where I worked on this model for like a quarter, made zero progress. We tried like 20 different things and it didn't work, but I kept trying on it. I kept trying to make it better.
Yeah.
But then, like, at that point, it's like, sure, I could make it better, but the relative to how much time I'm spending on it is not worth it. And I think the other thing that we missed is that we didn't take that step up front to define how this model actually drives business value. So that was like something that I did not do earlier in my career, that as a manager, I'm always thinking about, like, is what my team is working on like the most impactful thing they can be doing to the business? And if not, I need to talk to them and try to like realign with them on what they think is like, cause it's also like a partnership. As a manager, I did not like telling my team what to do. I would suggest things if they had a good reason to not do it. I'm totally okay with it.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah. So how do you decide when is a good time to give up on a project or double down on resources?
Yeah. So the way I think about these projects, a lot of projects, is that it's essentially like risk assessment, right? So if you have an idea, like, actually I can give examples. So
sure.
I had an IC who kind of developed this plan for this large scale ML system. And when I read through the plan, it was going to be like 9 months to do it. And we needed at least like 3 people on this project. And then, so to me, I was like, okay, cool. Like, we want to build this ML system. But that was very, very high risk. Like, we don't even know if the ML system is going to work. Is it going to create enough business value? And we could potentially be sinking like a good amount of our team's resources into something that's 9 months that may not even pan out. So to me, too risky. We cannot do a 9-month project with that type of risk. So my recommendation was that, hey, like, let's like whittle it down. Let's turn it into a 3-week project and prove out the value. Once we can prove out the value and we have high confidence that it's going to impact the business,
right,
then we commit to the 9-month project. And that way, like, worst case, you spend a few weeks on this analysis, find there's no value. That's okay. At least we get a learning out of it. We still get some value out of it. But it's like, ideally, you want the project length to be similar to the business value you have high confidence of achieving. So that's kind of how I see it. It's actually kind of like startups, right? Like, you want to build out a minimum viable product, make sure like there's like demand for your product before you build out the whole business. I think the same thing can be applied to work projects, where if you have a big idea for something, how can you actually test this project value within your company and prove out that value and get it validated before you like commit to the long version of that project?
Yeah. So do you have any advice on how do I kind of transform a big complicated problem into a smaller kind of POC project to test this idea?
Yeah. So typically with ML, big ML projects, you can usually kind of prove out the value. So I think there's 2 steps. So it's usually like opportunity assessment or impact sizing. And then you do exploratory analysis. Mm-hmm. So impact sizing is like basically, okay, if I build this ML model and I have this accuracy metric, how does improving this accuracy metric improve business value or create business value? If that connection is not clear, that should be the first step you do. You should just go figure out how your metric creates business value. Yeah. If you can't find that tie, or if you don't have a really good reason tie, then that's like probably a red flag, because then maybe there's like not that much value, or if there is value, you can't prove it to people. So then that's also going to be tough.
Right.
If you can prove that out, then you can say, okay, if I get an accuracy metric and prove it, this will create this much business value. But then can I reasonably hit that accuracy metric? Because you don't actually know what data points you have, what data you need. So you usually exploratory analysis, you do correlation analysis, look at a few scatter plots, see if you actually have enough signals in the data to actually reasonably hit that accuracy metric. And then once you, like, you can maybe even build a simple model. Once you build it and you know there's value there, then you're like, okay, like, I actually think I can build this model at a reasonably high confidence rate. Then that essentially validates your project. And then you can kind of move forward building it, doing a more complex version of it.
Yeah. So did you do a lot of opportunity sizing or impact sizing while you were at DoorDash?
Yeah. So basically, I think the great thing I really got from DoorDash is that all the data science projects we worked on at DoorDash, you had to opportunity size the impact of your project. So I always have a habit of doing it. And I think there's two benefits to it, is that one, you know how much value your project's going to bring. But like, that's fine. Like, it's pretty rough too. But I think the real benefit I get from it is you're thinking through how your project helps the business. And a lot of times, like, data scientists do not think about that. They just think about their model, but they don't translate their model output into business like impact. Yeah.
And sometimes it's difficult to translate your model into the business. So when you do this type of opportunity sizing, how do you know you're capturing the right size?
Yeah, so it's going to be very directional. You have to make assumptions about what's going to happen. And you really have to take your best guess. And I kind of think of it not necessarily absolute, but relative. So you have two projects. Relatively, how does one project compare to the other? Versus, I would say, like, oh, this is going to generate $100 million, right? You could use that to help prioritize, but if you're going to share it, you have to be a little bit more rigorous with it. There are other projects, like infrastructure projects, that are like, you can't really opportunity size or impact size infrastructure, like refactoring code. It's like, how do you really size that? So the way I think about it there is, what projects will be doing this thing enable me to realize business impact? Because I think that refactoring code itself maybe has some value, where it's like, you don't have to spend time fixing bugs, and like, you don't have to, you know, there's like a time savings aspect of like maintenance later on. That's like probably one part of the value. And then the other part of the value is like, okay, if I refactor this code, what kind of projects would this enable me to do? Or what can I do a future project like twice as fast? And that's probably where some of the value is. So you can still kind of back into it.
Yeah.
And if you can make a like strong enough case for it, then yeah, it would make sense.
Yeah. So now, although your title is not a data science manager, but I think from what I understand about the culture in Netflix, you are still a leader. You need to work with your different type of stakeholder. So what are some other things you learned from your experience as a manager now you can apply in Netflix as a senior data scientist?
So I think the cool thing, I think the important skills as a manager is you're the one kind of deciding the roadmap. You're deciding what's worth working on. You're the one prioritizing, and you're the one evaluating impact. So like, as a manager, you're doing it on the scale of your team. So you're doing it for like 5 to 7 other people.
Yeah.
I think at Netflix, I'm essentially going to be doing it for myself and maybe doing it for my team. But, you know, we also have a manager to help with that as well. So you're, but I think Netflix's culture is unique in the sense it's called like freedom and responsibility. So you get a lot of autonomy and freedom to kind of do what you want. And in order to do that well, you need to be able to know how to like be okay, like figuring out, hey, what's like the most valuable thing to be working on? How do I like make sure I'm properly prioritizing across all the work streams that I have? And then how do I make sure I'm executing well and realizing that impact? So the skills translate very much. It's just like, I'm not doing it for a team anymore. I'm just doing it for myself now.
Yeah. And some people feel if they want to grow their career, they can only grow to a manager and then later become a senior manager. And then you kind of out of this path a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about career growth as a data scientist?
Yeah, so I think the default people assume is that manager is a promotion. It's actually not. It's a parallel track. And being a good manager, I think you do need the technical skills to be a good manager. But I think there is a new set of skills that you have to learn to be a good manager that an IC is like less, like it's less needed, but also culturally dependent. Like I just said with Netflix, you kind of need some of those managerial skills. And Netflix will hire actually a lot of ex like managers and move them back to IC because they need that leadership component.
Oh.
But I would say that in general, though, it is more of a parallel track. So like as a manager, the skills you need to develop, you know, the road mapping, like, but then there's also like more soft skills, like how do you keep your team motivated? How do you give good feedback, high quality feedback? How do you build relationships with other people in the organization? These are all like very soft skills that currency is less valued as an IC. And then when you move into manager, you need to learn those skills.
And for folks who are not sure which path should they take, how can they test whether they want to be a manager or stay on the IC track?
Yeah. So I think there is a couple things. I think it's a combo of like reflecting on what your personal interests are and also experimentation. So you should like kind of reflect on, okay, what do I personally gravitate more towards? And I would guess that most people are like, oh, I don't know, or oh, I don't, like, you know, both are fine. And then if both are fine, or if you don't know, then that's like when you should be experimenting. So the way to experiment with it is that for a manager, you can start taking on manager types of tasks and see if you actually like doing it. So like you can actually take initiative to help with road mapping, interviewing more stakeholders, figuring out their problems. You could also take on an intern, see if you like. I had an ex coworker. She took on an intern. She was like, it wasn't a great experience for her, so she does not want to become a manager.
Yeah.
So, but that's like a lower risk way of testing out whether you like that kind of a job or not. And it's also like thinking about technically, do you personally enjoy technical work more, or do you personally enjoy like these people skills a lot more? And if you really enjoy the technical work, I would say like you will, you know, going the IC route, or if you get more personal fulfillment from creating work, building things and like deploying it, then IC seems like it'd probably be a better fit. If you get more fulfillment of like enabling a team and scaling your impact, then being a manager is probably the way to go. Because in theory, if you're like a director or a manager, you're essentially scaling your impact across your team. Like if you can get all your team members to do things well, it is like 10x the impact versus if you just do the IC work yourself. So yeah, so I would probably say that's like the way, those are some ways to think about it. And yeah.
Yeah. And now you have worked at DoorDash, Spotify, and now working at Netflix. How do you compare the company culture across those three companies?
Yeah, so this is just my impression. I really enjoyed working at all three companies, just very different cultures. Where at DoorDash, I would say I was at DoorDash during pre-IPO, so it was hyper growth mode. So things were definitely more intense right before the IPO to get things. Basically, we needed the business to be in a good state to open the books to the rest of the world. So things definitely were more intense at DoorDash, and like the work-life balance was definitely not as great. So that's what I would say at DoorDash. But I would say the good thing at DoorDash is people executed really quickly. Things got done really fast. And I would say, it was very like, because the business margins are very slim, people had to be very efficient with what they were doing.
Yeah.
Spotify is a little bit more established. So I would say like, and it's also a Swedish company. So it's mm-hmm. definitely more of a laid back, relaxed type of work culture. So if you want like good work-life balance, it's Spotify is like a great place to go. Mm-hmm. And people are very collaborative, very nice at Spotify. So yeah, that's what I would say at Spotify. Things probably could move a little bit faster at Spotify, but you know, I really enjoyed working. I was planning to stay at Spotify if I didn't get a new opportunity.
Right.
I found Netflix in terms of intensity to be like kind of right in between the two, where that Netflix is more intense than Spotify, but definitely like you're not working like 60 hours a week at Netflix, at least not yet. We'll see. And then I would say, but I think one particular thing is I noticed at Netflix is the culture is very unique. I think they have very famous culture memo, but Netflix has been able to move fast without necessarily putting in double the hours. And I think the structure is that Netflix is not a consensus-based culture. It's actually more of, they have something called informed captains, where as an informed captain, like you don't need to get everyone on board to make a decision. You are the person making the decision, but you will get everybody's opinions. And even if people disagree, the informed captain will just make a decision and move forward. Versus like a lot of other companies, they're more consensus-based. So you need to get everyone in the room to align to move forward, which will tend to slow things down.
Gotcha. Thanks for sharing. So across the three companies, has your tech stack changed a lot?
Yeah, every company is slightly different with tech stacks. So I've used a wide range of tech stacks now, like Redshift for data warehousing, Snowflake, Google Cloud, all those things. So I've tried a bunch. Tech stack generally kind of shifts depending on company tooling as well. So, and also what new tools come out. So, but overall, it's still like Python, SQL, you know, for data viz, I really don't like Tableau. So I started moving to Streamlit.
Okay.
And then, the general principles stay the same, but like maybe the data warehouse changes or like how I access, you know, EC2 instances might change, but yeah.
And what about those MLOps tools? For example, maybe looking at across experimentation, model performance, and putting model in production, what are some tools you use, or everything is already built in-house in Netflix?
Yeah, so Netflix, I'm still learning all the tools because I just started. But I would say at Netflix, Spotify, most of the tools are internally built. So Spotify has an ML platform tool called Hendrix, which essentially gives you like model tracking, you know, building out an endpoint, API endpoint, etc. Netflix also has their own internal. I haven't touched it yet, so I'm still like learning. At DoorDash, we had, at the time, I don't know if this is the case now, we had our own internal productionization systems, but we're also using like third parties as well.
Okay. I think it's interesting you mentioned you don't like Tableau and using more Streamlit. Can you share more about that?
Oh yeah. I just don't like Tableau because it's like, I don't feel like I have as much control over what's going on. And I feel like, I always feel like I have to like learn a weird combination of buttons to press to get stuff to work like I want versus, if it's just code, I can just tell the computer to do it versus Tableau. I need to like click one button, click one tab, click this other setting to be able to change certain things. So just like less intuitive to me. I just don't feel like I have as much control.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just don't really like it.
And when you use Streamlit, is it mostly for yourself to monitor the model, or you're creating this interactive interface for your stakeholder to play with the model?
Both. But I would say like I like Streamlit better because I have more control than it's just coding in Python. I think that Streamlit, like a web app, is better for operational tools, and then strategic insights is more better for Tableau. So I think Tableau has its own use cases. I do feel like there's also limitations of Streamlit as well. Like, because same thing why I don't like Tableau is that on Streamlit, you're abstracting away a lot of the front end and back end engineering components, where sometimes we run into problems like if the app doesn't load, like, it's hard for me to open up the inner code of Streamlit to figure out why. I think one time we had like some sort of timeout. Streamlit has an internal 500 second timeout that we can't change. And because of that, we were just like always hitting that timeout limit, and it would auto timeout every time. And it was just very frustrating because we couldn't actually change the thing within Streamlit. So I still think there's a case to be made that like just knowing the whole full stack SWE is better, but it's just like more cumbersome to get stuff out. So, but I think as a data scientist, I just tend to like Streamlit a lot more.
Yeah. Previously, we talked a little bit about LLMs and its impact on forecasting. Have you adopted any, say, coding tools empowered by Gen AI LLMs in your kind of day-to-day workflow?
Yeah, so I use ChatGPT a lot for debugging code. It's been really useful for commands that I forget. Like, I always forget the, what's it called? Like, reverting branches on Git. I always forget that one. Some of the terminal commands I also forget, or some I use it a lot to parse error messages if I don't really know what the error message is saying. So like as an IC, I definitely use it a lot more. As a manager, I did not use it as much, but I'm like using it quite often.
Yeah. And what do you think about the future of, let's just say, forecasting?
Future of forecasting. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's going in the direction of transformers. I would say, yeah, that's where it seems like things are going. ML does seem like it's catching up or like it's starting to surpass, perform better than univariate time series models. There's probably a world where there needs to be, it's not a not as sexy of a space as other areas, but I think it's going to get just more and more important. And yeah, I'll have to think about that one a little bit more. I would say like it does seem like the more complex methods are starting to surface and win out in competition. So we'll see if it actually ends up kind of winning. Or like I don't know for forecasting. I think it's like, I'm just thinking out loud now. With forecasting, it feels like making the models better is the easy answer here.
Yeah.
Like the more complex models. But I think what it's like really, it's probably less of a modeling problem and more of a data collection problem. Like, can we actually accurately collect more signals in the external world and use that and make it like ingestible? Because that's actually probably going to make the best biggest boost for all of any forecasting model than just having a more complex model.
Yeah. And throughout your career, has there been a mentor that helps you a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I think throughout my career, a lot of like past managers have been really helpful. Like some of my past managers at DoorDash really honed in on like business impact. And when I was working on something, I would say like other managers have like given me a pretty loose leash and I can kind of like figure out what to do and figure out how to operate. So that was great. I would say I also learned from a lot of peers as well, where some were very technically strong.
Yeah.
There's some peers at DoorDash who are really strong in experimentation, where I feel like they were the reason why I was able to learn so much on the experimentation side. Same with the ML modeling and causal inference side. So I would say like different mentors for different areas of my skill sets.
And what is a piece of important feedback you got from, say, could be your manager or your peers?
I think the biggest impact of feedback I got was actually when I was at DoorDash is that I really focused on executing things well, but I was failing to understand the problem that I was solving.
Yeah.
And that's actually the most important thing, is that you need to make sure you know what you're trying to solve for first and spend more time understanding that versus just trying to like build stuff and go off track. So that was like a big piece of feedback that I still always remember today. And I always put in an effort to understand the problem a lot, and then also like use that to help understand the impact of that problem and whether the problem's even worth working on.
Yeah. And while we're talking, I can see that you have good communication skills. Were you always, you know, good at speaking, or it is something you have honed over the, you know, the past few years?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say I was always pretty good at communicating more naturally than other data scientists.
Yeah.
I think it's because I had a more background in consulting and business. So that's like one I would say. But I have gotten feedback on like, you basically need to like be able to talk at the right level for your audience when you're communicating and being empathetic to your audience. And a lot of times when I was younger, I would get too in the weeds. I think a lot of data scientists make this mistake, get too in the weeds of like what they're explaining, the details of the model, and not calibrate it to whoever they're talking to. So that part, I put in some work to like get it right. But yeah, I would say like, I kind of, but like naturally had decent communication skills.
Yeah. And has playing poker helped in any way in your career?
I think poker has been really helpful for giving me a framework to think about my own life decisions. So with poker, I think the main benefit has been more on the lines of like thinking probabilistically with certain decisions and knowing that certain decisions may not actually be the right, they may be the best, they may be the right decisions, but you get the bad outcome.
Yeah.
So like in poker, you can make the right play, but you can still lose money, but you have to be able to stay calm and know that you made the right decision.
Yeah.
And I think in real life, life is also a game of imperfect information. So you need to make the best decision. You might get the bad outcome, but as long as you keep making the right decisions, the law of large numbers will start to take into effect, and you'll come out profitable.
Yeah. I think when you play poker, you definitely make a lot of moves. You can rely on law of large numbers. But when it comes to career moves, we don't make that many career moves. So how do you make sure you're making the right decision?
So I think it actually applies to career moves as well, right? So like I'll give you an example of like a bad move that is negative expected value. So let's say that you were like an English major in college, right? And you became a journalist, right? And then you suddenly decide, I want to be a data scientist at this company, right? Well, if you just quit your, if you're deciding to quit your job and just pursue data science, that's, I think like it could work, but to me, that's like a negative expected value move. Not saying that you can't accomplish it, but I think the way to stack the odds in your favor is to actually try it out, do a test class, see if you even like it, and then see if you have aptitude for it. And then if you have aptitude for it, that kind of actually like improves your probability of succeeding. And then that way, you know, you also have confidence that you can succeed. If you just jump straight into it, it's like very high risk. You may hate it. You may not like it. You don't even know the path to getting there. So like naturally, if you like figured out the path saying, oh, I'm a journalist. I know words very well. I'm going to start studying linguistics and get into NLP. Makes a lot more sense in terms of a career move than becoming, oh, I'm a journalist. I'm going to become like a mathematician or like a research scientist. Possible, but much harder. So that's like another one. I would say like, like in terms of like using our previous examples, it's like also deciding whether you want to be a manager or a IC, right?
Yeah.
Like the way to turn it into a right move is that you look at your strengths, you look at what the opportunities are on the market, and you also look at, you know what like you're prioritizing in your job and using that to inform your decision, versus like if you just haphazardly make a decision, that's like not really like the best way to go about it. So I guess like the way I'm thinking about it is it's like the process of evaluating your decision-making process is probably the most important thing.
And how do you see your career grow? Do you see yourself becoming a manager in the next few years, or change your career laterally to a different industry?
So I would say like, I think it's also like, I'm going to evaluate it year by year as well, depending on what's in front of me. Because with this new job at Netflix, I wasn't expecting to change jobs, right? So like things do pop up and you evaluate it as they come up. So the way I'm thinking about it is like, I have a direction. Like I am interested in entrepreneurship. I don't mind going back to being a manager if it makes sense. Those are potential paths. But I'm thinking about it also from the perspective of like, how do I maximize positive serendipity? So I think the way to like maximize positive serendipity. Basically, you want good luck to happen, opportunities to come to you.
Yeah.
From, and I think the way to do that is actually to get good at what you do, get good at your, like, have strong skill sets, and also like be out there and like have some sort of presence where people can actually find you.
Yeah.
And if people can find you, then like, and you have the skill sets, then it's like, okay, new opportunities can come, and then you evaluate them as they come.
Yeah. I think that makes sense, because right now there's a lot of changes in the data science industry. So I think it's good to evaluate on a year by year base. I think a few years ago, hiring managers usually ask, oh, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I think that now doesn't really make sense for you to know where you're going to be in 5 years. But I think it still makes sense to have a general prediction or an estimation and walk towards that goal, but at the same time be flexible.
Yeah, I think you should still have a direction to move towards, and then but you also have a sense that, like, you still stay open to alternative paths that may come up, because data scientist was not really a job like over like 15 to 20 years ago. Right. So like, yeah, so it's like really like have a direction, but also like be open to different paths that may pop up that we are unaware of right now.
Yeah. And you mentioned you're interested in entrepreneurship. Are you building any cool projects on the side?
Yeah. So I have a couple things. So I worked with, I think, you know, Ken G on a machine learning course that we've launched on 365 Data Science. And I'm also working on an AI dating text assistant called yourmove.ai, where it's essentially using AI to help you come up with openers, replies, follow-up messages, and just help, just overall help you like communicate better in the dating environment.
Yeah, that's cool. So how does AI work? Do you fine-tune a model? Are you using OpenAI API?
So I would say like we probably won't say exactly how we're doing it, but I would say like at a high level, we're using a combo of many different things to try to come up with the best responses that you can use.
Yeah. And what's your motivation of creating this product?
Yeah. So I think for me, it's really just to like solve my own problem with dating.
Yeah.
And it's also to learn entrepreneurship. So I'm very motivated by learning and like developing new skills. So I would say like those are probably the two things. I also worked on some dating AIs in the past as well. So when I met my co-founder on this, it made a lot of sense because I already was working in it. I was interested in the space. I was interested in the problems here.
Yeah.
And then,
And what are some new skills you're learning right now?
Yeah. So I think the biggest skill I'm learning is just business sense and like having a sense of like what actually works and what doesn't work and how to like think through a lot of these business ideas and understand and also really like operating in a place where things are not super clear like in terms of direction. So operating in ambiguity has been really good. It's also like a skill of, I guess I call it a skill of like hacking where you like you don't really know how to do a lot of things, but you just have this problem, so you just need to go figure out how to do it with whatever tools that you need to figure out. So yeah, so I think that's trained like more directly business skills, but also a lot of these meta skills as well.
Yeah, I think you can learn a lot of business skills through actually building an app, building a business. Are there any books or blogs, other resources you think that's helpful for you to hone the business sense?
Yeah, so I mean, I used to read a lot of these books and blogs, and yeah, honestly, the best way to do it is actually just try to build it, the business. And then once like what happens is that, let's say you want to start a business, right? I mean, there's like some books, I think Peter Levels, his book Make has a good framework for approaching it. But yeah, I would probably recommend you first, maybe you get one resource and then just try to do it.
Yeah.
And then every time you do it, you're going to like encounter some sort of problem. And then when you have that problem and you go read the book and research it to like solve your problem. And then once you find the solution to your problem, you go back to trying to do it and you capture another problem. You find another problem. It's going to come up and then you go back to your resources to do it.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually the best approach than just to like read books. Cause then I think that you'll basically turn the knowledge into like actual tacit experience. and then you can actually, and then, and it stays with you for a while. So like, if you want to start a business, you're like, okay, what's the first step? The first step is, oh, I need to find an idea. Then you can say, oh, how do I find an idea? Oh, look at my problems in my life. Come up with a bunch of ideas. And then you can like say, okay, the next step is, how do I test the idea? Okay, like, I don't know how to do that, so I'm gonna go read this book to figure out how to do that. I'm like, okay, this is how I do it. And then you can go back to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you do besides doing data science or building your app?
Yeah, so I do, I mean, I like, I think most of the time I spend outside of data science and side projects is sports. So I really like surfing, snowboarding, jiu-jitsu, spending a lot of time with friends, hanging out, you know, getting food, basic, pretty basic New York hobbies, which is getting food and getting drinks with people. So yeah, that's pretty much it though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like you have a pretty balanced life.
I try to. It's still tough. Like I'm still trying to figure out how to balance everything. Mm. But like, I was actually listening to a podcast as I was coming here, which I thought by Ed Thorpe. Have you heard of him?
No.
He's like a guy who started quant finance. Mm-hmm. But what I really liked about his story is that he is basically one of the few people that I've seen, like when I listen to these like biographies, where he's actually kind of figured out all aspects of his life. Like maybe not fully, but like he has made a lot of money. He's also, he has a great family. He's a good dad. He's also very healthy. He's like 90 and he's like running marathons and ultra marathons. So it feels like he's kind of figured out all three buckets versus usually these very successful people. They're like over indexed on professional success and they have like a terrible family life or their health sucks. So I actually don't want to be like those guys. So Ed Thorpe was actually a really good example. I'm like, oh yeah, you can actually, like he's able to figure out all of it. So
Yeah. And what do you think about the future of work? Mm-hmm. Do you think eventually we are still have to clock in, say, 40 hours a week and remote work? So, and also I think with Gen Z, I've seen some reports, it's kind of harder to push them to, say, work overtime or sacrifice their personal hobby. What do you think about the future, maybe more specifically for tech workers?
Are you thinking more like high level economically or just anything?
Anything that comes to your mind. For example, some people argue that there might be more data scientists leaving their full-time job, become a freelancer. Mm-hmm. Some people also say that data science freelancing is hard because you have to do data engineering, ML ops. So, and I think it's just from, especially after the pandemic, I think more and more people I talk to want to optimize their life as a whole instead of just thinking about, oh, I want to get another promotion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty open question.
Yeah, so I think that with, so there's like a few angles I can answer this where I think from the work perspective, I think PM skills are going to be more and more important, especially with LLMs and AI coming to fruition. Like it's going to be less needed for you to just write the code because you can actually ask the LLM to do it.
Right.
You still kind of have to know it to know if it's right or not. Mm. But it's, I think the parts that are harder to automate is how do you define the problem that you want to solve? And how do you like kind of break down a problem or find the problems in an ambiguous environment? Mm. That's like hard for an AI to answer without knowing all the context of whatever you're working in. So my theory is that most companies or like a data scientist's role is going to kind of shift more towards, if you have these PM skills, you're going to know how to operate and leverage the best tooling and data science tooling for the job. Because at some point it does feel like you can abstract away a lot of the code and you can actually do like, you just use a tool for a certain job.
Yeah.
That's like just my thought on evolution of the data science role and position. I would say that's one. I would say in terms of the high level, like evolution of a company, I think that like, I'm kind of thinking about this on the spot without actually thinking it through where it feels like there is a pushback on, So yeah, I don't know if this is okay. This is just like my thought, like with the idea of like work. Yeah, this is not very well parsed, but I think there's like there's room for startups to work 40 to 60 hours a week and not need to work like 100 hours a week and still have a good life and still be able to grow really quickly. I think with the like new AI technology, a lot of like new developments and how the ecosystem is run, like it's going to be less correlated with the pure number of hours you put in. It's going to be more correlated with the leverage you have that you're able to capitalize on. So I think AI can become leverage. The internet is good leverage. So how do you actually grow and capitalize on leverage? So you actually can work 40 hours a week and still grow like a rocket ship.
Yeah.
That's like one. I don't know if that's going to actually happen, but I'd like that to happen. So yeah, but those are a couple of thoughts.
Yeah. What are something you're excited in the next couple of months in your, could be your career or your personal life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm like still new at Netflix. So I'm still really trying to just get up to speed on everything going on and deliver value. So I'm enjoying it a lot. So I am pretty excited about that. Yeah. Coming up, I have like some surf trips planned, some friends trips, some ski trips planned as well. Mm. So that's also like on the horizon. So I'm pretty excited about those things.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And for folks who want to follow your career, maybe learn more about the course you built and the app you created, where can they find you?
Yeah. So I have my personal website is jeffleechronicles.com. Mm. So you can find that, or you could just search Google Jeff Lee data science. Pretty easy to find. And if you want to check out the AI app, it's yourmove.ai. You can also search that on Google. And then my ML course is on 365 data science. Mm-hmm. So we have two courses, the ML process and the ML algorithms course as well.
Oh,
done
awesome.
With Kenji. Yep.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for coming to the show, Jeff.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.